Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
It's 2017. Busyness is a marker of status. Our digital environments offer endless instant gratification. Our calendars are packed, and many of us live in a constant state of overstimulation. Welcome to the age of hyperactivity. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Our dependence on an endless stream of little pops of pleasure and reminders of our own importance is like all addictions. It produces euphoria in the short term, but can exhaust and poison us in the long run. When did we lose our capacity to savor calm, quiet reflection? And what is lacking in a life scheduled around our fear of missing out? Journalist and author Eva Hoffman explores these big questions in her new book, How to Be Bored. She joins us this hour from the studios of the BBC in London. Eva, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Hello.
Why do we equate being busy with being popular and important?
I think, you know, it's a sort of cultural phenomenon. I mean, it's one of the ways that we define being important and being successful. We are wanted. We feel that we're wanted, that, you know, that what we do matters to somebody, that we are not left to our own devices. I mean, it's really a kind of cultural phenomenon. America was very much formed by its work ethic, which says precisely that it is effort and work which counts and which makes you a worthwhile person. And I'm not sure that, you know, we live in the age of the work ethic anymore, but we do live in the age in which activity, or what I call hyperactivity, seems to lend us importance.
Eva, what makes hyperactivity in the social and not the medical sense so addictive?
On one level, that it gives us a sense of being important. In the short run, it gives us little hits of pleasure. Get the stimulus of an email or a phone call or an activity, in the short run, it can be sort of hedonistic and pleasurable. But in the longer run, it is actually very depleting, and it can have genuinely adverse effects. I mean, especially digital addiction, which is a genuine, almost medically classified phenomenon. So, for example, you know, there are detox camps in China and in Korea, South Korea, for adolescents who are trying to disabuse themselves of this addiction, and they suffer terrible withdrawal symptoms. I mean, you know, withdrawal symptoms as if from drugs, while trying to stay disconnected for, you know, let's say more than 15 minutes. So it really is addictive. And also these adolescents often get into very bad states while they remain connected to their devices, or, you know, completely absorbed or completely lost in their games. They forget to eat, they forget to drink, etc.
There was a time when at least being at home meant being somewhat isolated from overactivity. That has changed.
Well, this has changed, yes. This has changed radically. And in a sense, this is, you know, one of the ways in which this phenomenon of incessant activity is different from the work ethic. It continues into our non-work lives. It continues into our home lives, you know, which have been called the third shift by some sociologists, because our home lives can be so busy for various reasons. You know, first of all, if we're middle class, we have extremely high standards of perfectionism. We want our children to be perfect. But also because we can take our computers to bed with us.
Yeah.
You know, and also it continues into our vacations, which we also make into these tasks that we have to perform.
One challenge that you note that's a major factor in modern Western industrialized societies is choice. We demand it, but it can also be this extraordinary burden. And you note that you have moments of a strange kind of nostalgia for your childhood in Eastern Europe, where there just weren't so many choices to be made in picking out shampoo or house paint or whatever you needed.
Indeed. I mean, you know, it must be said that in Eastern Europe of my childhood, in the 1950s and 60s, there were real shortages of choice, but there was a sort of luxury to it. One did not have to spend, hours shopping or trying to figure out what one wants or what is preferable. And, you know, now we're very prone to shopping addiction, for sure. I mean, we have, extravagant quantities of consumer choices. But more than that, I mean, we have choices in every area of our lives, you know, from career to partners, to our own sexuality, to the sexuality of our partners, to how we want to have children, etc., etc. Now, you know, this is all to the good, but we also live in this very individualistic society. So all of these choices have to be made individually. Again, I am, you know, absolutely not arguing against that. But, you know, what I do think is that this demands, this is a very demanding condition, that we need to know what we want. We need to know what we think. We need to know what our values are. We need to figure all of this out from within ourselves. Because there is no sort of general code or value system which tells us how to proceed about this very wide range of choice.
And we tend to attach way too much meaning to a lot of these choices. I mean, life is not going to be less than fantastic if we paint the walls the wrong shade of blue. But our consumer culture tells us that it might be, and that it's worth spending all this time and energy on making decisions that ultimately mean nothing.
Indeed. And, you know, we do need to figure out what is meaningful to us. And it is not at all easy. I mean, the pressures of these external temptations and seductions and a kind of externalized value system which says, you know, that you need to have a perfect home or you're not a worthwhile person or you need to be dressed in a particular way or you're not a worthwhile person. All of these pressures are considerable. So again, you know, the demand for knowing who we are and knowing, you know, what we find meaningful is great. I mean, you know, there are sociologists, there's one particular book called The Challenges of Affluence, and it's about this, and it's about the enormous pressure that the sort of the plethora of choice and the plenitude that we have imposes on us.
You insist that leisure is not the same as laziness. What is the most important difference between the two?
I think moments of idleness can also be very important and very fruitful, and we need them. We need time out from sort of instrumental tasks. But, I mean, leisure can be used. I mean, leisure is, in my sense of the word, the use of time to do something that is pleasurable or important to you or meaningful to you or that enriches you, but that is not a task and that is not instrumental. You're not driving towards a particular result or towards a particular purpose. You're using leisure to reflect and to think or to look inwards, you know, for introspection, which is so much needed precisely because of all of these external pressures. We use it, you know, it's a use of time to increase our knowledge, our self-knowledge. I mean, you know, leisure in classical philosophy was thought to be the foundation of culture. precisely because it allows you to do things which nourish you and nurture you and which develop you as a person, as a human being.
This book has given me a lot to think about. I will confess that I often wish I had more free time, but then when I do, I have no packed schedule for the day. It's very hard for me to shift to that different pace and actually embrace free time. I find myself looking for a project to fill the space. Does being bored, using leisure, being idle, does it take practice?
I think it takes a kind of self-discipline, paradoxically. We need to give ourselves permission to do that, I think. You know, we need to understand that this is not wasting time, you know, that this is not, in fact, laziness, that this is not slothfulness. I mean, you know, slothfulness used to be associated with a kind of sinfulness. We need to understand that that is not what it is. And, you know, we do need to put aside time, I think, for these other kinds of pursuits, for these other kinds of endeavors and explorations. We need to put aside time for them, you know, quite deliberately. And then, you know, allow ourselves to explore, to surrender ourselves to these other kinds of activities or, as I say, pursuits.
You write about a friend who has decided that for one day a week she will not do anything that she doesn't really want to do. It sounds like a great idea, but forgive me for assuming that this friend doesn't have a job or a partner or kids or, you know, the things that we all feel like keep us from doing things.
She doesn't have kids, but she has a demanding job and a partner.
So how does she make it work?
Well, she has made the resolution to do so. I mean, you know, probably all of us can afford a day a week, or maybe if not a day a week, let's say an afternoon a week plus some hours in the evening. All of us can afford that if we decide, you know, that this is what we want to do. You know, I mean, we don't have to be a kind of instrumentally busy for, I don't know, 16 hours a day. So, you know, she just values this time. I also have, it's a question of giving it value. I also have a composer friend, you know, who tells me that he spends a part of each morning just, you know, sipping his coffee and staring into space and letting things arise within him. In his case, you know, musical motifs maybe. And he's also a very disciplined artist who at other times, you know, works hard at composing in his case, but he finds this crucial to his creative process.
My guest is journalist and author Eva Hoffman. Her new book is called How to Be Bored. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist and author Eva Hoffman. Her new book is called How to Be Bored. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. So at the heart of this, Eva, is really a celebration of getting back in touch with our inner lives. You caution that we need to be careful about confusing telling a lot about our personal lives on social media with actually being in touch with our inner selves.
Yes. You know, our communications on social media do tend to be quite superficial. And, you know, come in these sound bites and these, you know, sort of short little spurts of messages. They do not give insight to others about who we are, and they can divert us, you know, from our own sort of thinking about what we feel, about who we are, about what is going on inside us. They're two-dimensional as opposed to our three-dimensional selves. We do have internal lives, and I don't think those really get recorded on social media very much.
What did you learn about the astonishing variability in people's inner lives when you were studying psychoanalysis?
Well, you know, just that it is astonishing that people's conflicts and tensions attach themselves to all kinds of things, you know, that people can become worried or troubled by very small incidents, or that, you know, that you know, there can be very odd symptoms. I mean, people can start, I don't know, forgetting keys to their house all the time, or not being able to fall asleep until it's light and they hear noise from the street. I mean, you know, there are endless varieties. And, you know, it is important to acknowledge all of that, to acknowledge the small things that bother us, you know, the sense of slight that we might experience from our colleagues, and to try to think, was this really a slight? Am I, you know, prone to esteeming myself too highly or not esteeming myself at all? It's important to try to get in touch, you know, to use the very colloquial phrase, with sort of the sources of our tensions and conflicts, and the sources of our subjective lives. And it's also, you know, it's also important, in a sense, to become conscious of all of that, to cultivate our minds and our consciousness, as well as our feelings.
I know a number of people who swear by the value of journal writing, and to be honest, I think I know even more who have tried it and, for whatever reason, couldn't sustain it. Is there a way to get that habit right?
Well, again, I mean, I think you need to, in a sense, you know, frame it within a specific time so that you know this is what you're going to do. That's one way. I mean, it must be said that the other way is to write, you know, let's say sometime in the evening, when something has happened during the day that, you know, has been interesting or disturbing or that you want to think out. There are various ways. I mean, I think, you know, that again, in our sort of over busy and over stressed lives, we need to make specific time for it. You know, it can be done in 15-minute segments. I mean, we don't need to write pages upon pages. But I do think, you know, it really helps to articulate and to give lucidity to this kind of swirl of, you know, subliminal feelings or, you know, semi-thoughts that we might have, but that we don't really articulate.
All right, let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Brad calling from Plano. Hello, Brad.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Yeah. I wanted to tell you my story. I'm a retired technical recruiter, but I was never good at sales, so I've always been fired from all my jobs or sales jobs. But I've got some former partners that are being giving me money, and I appreciate that. And I'm a disability too, so I make money. My wife keeps me busy with doing things around the house, cleaning the pool and stuff. But I just wanted to say that I'm much happier with a lot of free time, and I do have time to take care of myself, learning to play the piano and running and stuff like that. So.
Thanks for your call.
Well, that's very nice to hear. It is very nice to hear. I mean, I do think, you know, that while we can sort of think and feel for a while and assume that being excited and stimulated all the time is great. I mean, in fact, you know, after a while, it really leaves us feeling very frayed and very depleted. We do need to pay attention to ourselves, really. So that's very nice to hear.
You have a phrase in the book that I absolutely love. You say that reading is a form of solitude that banishes loneliness. We do it alone, but we don't feel lonely.
Well, absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, books speak back to us, and they speak to us very richly. I mean, you know, good books. They are a form of conversation. The best kind of conversation, really. And they also offer us this thing which is a luxury nowadays, which is stretches of continuous time and, you know, continuous thinking and continuous immersion in something. It's very different, you know, from clicking on your devices and, you know, looking for one bit of information after another, or from going from one Twitter message to another. It is, you know, something which has become a luxury, but which is incredibly enriching and nourishing.
Does it matter what kind of reading we do, if it has literary merit or not?
Well, you know, I mean, you know, Henry James, the 19th century novelist, said, you know, the house of fiction has a million windows, and so does the house of nonfiction. There is such a plethora of wonderful books. I mean, there is such a treasury that we have. We need to figure out what we like, what we prefer, why we want to read something. I think literary merit matters in that it usually goes, with a kind of depth of perception. Books which are not very good can give us very little in terms of understanding other people, understanding the human condition, understanding the world. Better books give us more of that.
All right, let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Bruce is calling from Grand Prairie. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. I found that a lot of times that the commodities that we own usually takes up a lot of our attention or sap our attention. And I found that, like, it can either take up a lot of cluttering the area or just keeping up maintaining them. I found that, you know, adopting more of like a minimalist mindset of seeing what, before like purchasing an item or something, seeing if it, whether or not it adds to your life or multiplies to it, or whether it subtracts time from your life.
Thanks so much for your call, Bruce. What do you think about trying to declutter our physical space, Eva? Is this helpful?
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, it's probably helpful too. I certainly find it helpful, but then I'm a kind of quantity phobic. I don't think, you know, that obsession with neatness is quite the solution to that. We need to make our environments, you know, pleasant for ourselves and comfortable for ourselves, and, you know, perhaps aesthetically appealing for ourselves. all of which I think, you know, actually does affect our mental states to some extent. So I think, you know, certainly decluttering, if we have newspapers piled up on the desk, or you know, in my case, at some points, you know, books piled up to the ceiling, I do find that I need to clear that space, and that clearing external space very much helps to clear internal space as well.
What is so mentally satisfying about walking? Not you know, just from the kitchen to the bedroom, but walking for distance.
Probably, I mean, you know, first of all, it is a kind of natural activity. It is, you know, perhaps just, you know, simply the pace of movement, which is invigorating but not stressful like running. There have been sort of suggestions that walking frees the movement of the mind, that walking and thinking are extremely compatible. I'm sure there is, you know, a neurology of that. There is a neuroscientific explanation of that, but I don't know it. But, you know, they are very compatible activities. And, of course, there is a great tradition of, you know, particularly English, you know, poets and writers from Coleridge to William Hazlitt, who were great walkers and who thought... Who thought of their stories or of their poems often while they were walking. And, you know, it's also perhaps, you know, the combination of structure and variety. I mean, in other words, if you are walking through some lovely countryside, you are structuring your walk, but you have a kind of variety of perceptions.
You're listening to things.
And it kind of frees, in a way, it kind of frees our doors of perception. It frees us to just, you know, look around and notice what is around us. You know, in a sense, I am arguing for giving some legitimacy to pleasure. that all of these things are pleasurable. And if we only drive ourselves and are always, you know, thinking of 17 things that we could be doing at the same time, we lose the sense of pleasure in being in the moment, in being alive, or even in the important things that we do.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist and author Eva Hoffman. Her new book is called How to Be Bored. It's interesting when you say you are arguing for pleasure, because on the one hand, it feels like this moment in time, we are so hedonistic, and yet we are so goal-driven. So that, for instance, we might take a walk, but we do it with all of our athletic gear on and special shoes, and we need to get our heart rate above a certain rate. And there's not anything wrong about that necessarily, but we feel strangely guilty about just taking a stroll for its own sake.
Well, precisely, and it seems to me that hedonism is different from pleasure, and you know, from relishing experiences, part of the difference is that hedonism can become very frenetic, but also, as you say, we have lost the sense of doing things spontaneously, or because we like to do them, or because we want to do them, or because we want to relish our experiences, relish the moment. I mean, in a sense, you know, we're always kind of hectically immersed in activity or in sort of, you know, the digital world. We lose the sense, we lose our ability to really experience our experience.
It seems that a lot of people who really love fishing are not that concerned with whether they actually catch any fish.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question?
Yeah, a lot of people who love to go fishing are not necessarily concerned with whether they catch any fish. It's very much more about the experience than about the product.
Mm. Well, absolutely. You know, I mean, fishing is one of the great contemplative activities. It's not that one that I've ever engaged in, but I do know, you know, that this is how it is felt. And, you know, there is great poetry and, you know, there are great books written about fishing. And yes, it is, you know, for the sake of experiencing the moment and allowing yourself to be contemplative, to be meditative, while perhaps, you know, also doing something in a way. And, you know, I mean, after all, creativity is also often contemplative. It cannot be sort of forced, and its pace cannot be forced.
The idea that we do our best thinking in the shower is almost a joke. We've all experienced it. Why, if we know that experience of having an epiphany and finding that really pleasurable, why does it take so much discipline to engage in this kind of thinking when we are dry and fully dressed?
Well, because, you know, I think we don't give it enough value. We have, you know, forgotten. We have forgotten the value of that. You know, I was actually thinking about a conversation I had with a very senior editor at the New York Times who had to make some, you know, very tough decisions about various news, about news coverage. And I remember him saying, you know, if I really come to the end of my rope, if I really want to figure out what I want to do, I take a long walk. You know, I think, for example, of, you know, Winston Churchill, who made time to paint even in the midst of World War II. And, you know, he thought it was absolutely crucial to his ability to make good decisions. So, you know, it takes a kind of understanding that this is important, and that we won't, in fact, you know, that we're not wasting time, that this is not time wasting.
My guest is journalist and author Eva Hoffman. We're talking about her new book, How to Be Bored. If you'd like to join us, you can find us on Twitter at KERA Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, talking this hour with Eva Hoffman about her new book, How to Be Bored. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Todd, who writes, "The ancient concept of the Sabbath as a day of rest may have been lost to societies throughout the industrialized world. Perhaps the Sabbath is still a good idea, observed through religion or not." What do you think, Eva?
Well, yes. I mean, it is an excellent idea. I mean, you know, in a sense, one of the ways in which religions are sort of helpful in sort of conducting our lives. I'm a very secular person, but nevertheless, you know, they give us structures, and one of the structures is precisely, you know, this idea of the Sabbath and taking time out, and having a different kind of time, and giving time to being contemplative, to, you know, thinking about the values in our lives. So yes, I mean, in a sense, this is exactly what I'm advocating, and this is what my friend, who somehow manages, you know, to take a day each week to do just what she feels like doing and to be contemplative, or to, you know, write in her journal, in her case, is doing. And, you know, I think it's very fruitful. It's very fruitful. Because I think, you know, that one of the sort of hidden assumptions that we make is that we become productive if we drive ourselves all the time very hard. But, you know, I don't think this is true. I think we do need this time out to restoke our energies, our physical energies, but, you know, the energies of our perceptions, our mental energies, our inner energies. And it's only if we come to our, you know, to the things that matter to us, to our work or relationships, with those fresh energies, that we can lend ourselves to them, that we can become fully engaged in them, and that, you know, we can do something that is productive and interesting.
That's really interesting because, you know, I guess to those who say that this all sounds a little bit self-absorbed and self-indulgent, you're saying if we haven't connected with ourselves and really given some thought to our inner lives, we don't have much to give anybody else.
Yes, and, you know, we may not have much to give to our, to the things which matter to us, you know, including our work. I mean, you know, I don't know if this phrase is still used, you know, the idea of burnout.
Yeah.
I mean, we know that is a possibility. You know, we can burn out. And also there have been all kinds of studies about productivity, and they do not depend. I mean, in fact, you know, productivity decreases if we work beyond a certain number of hours. So there is all of that. But indeed, you know, if we drive ourselves ragged and if we live in these, you know, brief sound bites and these discontinuous bits of time, then we lose our capacity to pay attention to another person, to give ourselves to relationships, to give ourselves to intimacy. All of that also, you know, takes a kind of understanding of what it means to be a human self, understanding of ourselves, understanding, and therefore understanding of others. I mean, in order to have insight into others, we need to have insight into ourselves, but also we need to spend some continuous time with them. You know, I think that knowing another person doesn't happen in little brief intervals, and I don't think it happens properly on social media. I do not mean to sound like, you know, a digital Luddite. I do think that, you know, the internet has given us a lot, but it also, I think, you know, holds these dangers. And I think, you know, it distances us and it removes us from ourselves if it's overused.
We have an email from Kelly in Dallas who writes, last month as a 60th birthday present, my family, friends, and coworkers collaborated to give me 2 weeks in which to backpack alone 200 miles across Big Bend National Park. I returned such a changed and better man. On my journey, I went 11 days without seeing another human being. A sharp break from the crashing waves of daily life is well worth it.
Yes, well, that's lovely. It sounds like a wonderful experience. I mean, you know, you're a brave man. I mean, that is a long time to be quite alone. But it's so interesting that you say that, you know, solitude can be so refreshing and re-energizing.
Kelly's email also reminds me that throughout history, pilgrimage has been very important to people in many different societies for many different reasons. And of course, there were, you know, places that they were trying to go, but it seems there was also meaning in the journey itself.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. I mean, that is, you know, in a sense, well, first of all, you know, a very structured experience in which you do have a goal. Secondly, an experience of, you know, perhaps of a kind of community, of a kind of meaningful sociability. And, you know, interestingly enough, pilgrimages are becoming popular once again. And it's not for religious reasons. I think, you know, it's for the reasons that I just mentioned, that it gives people you know, that it enables people to commit themselves to doing something over an extended time and to doing it for its own sake. Yes, I mean, you know, there is a very interesting book by a young American writer, and unfortunately, the title escapes me now, but it is about, you know, his experiments. I mean, he lived in, he's sort of, you know, cool young writer who lived in Brooklyn, then you know, went to Berlin for a while, got absolutely immersed in its, you know, very active and frenetic and hedonistic art scene. And after a while, in fact, got bored with that and got very depleted and very confused, and decided to go on a pilgrimage, which was a transformative experience.
How can we approach... I'm sorry, please go ahead.
Yes, no, because, you know, one of the things that, you know, is perhaps worth saying is that, in fact, you know, this kind of immersion in frenetic activity and hyperactivity can, after a while, become paradoxically boring. Mm. It can lead to a kind of, you know, different kind of depletion, to a different kind of boredom.
Yeah, well, there's only so much stimulation that we can take, right, before our natural defenses go up and we don't really feel much even from the most exciting experience ever.
Exactly. Yes. I mean, you know, we lose our experience. I mean, you know, and that is a real waste of time and of our lives and of our potential.
The way we have been talking, people might come away with the idea that there is your work life, your obligations, and then there is this rich, awesome inner life that we hope to cultivate, but that they are mutually exclusive. Can you talk about maybe ways that we can find to approach our work in such a way that it enhances our inner lives rather than interfering with them?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm not talking only about the inner life. I am talking also about imaginative exploration, about reading, about, let's say, you know, walking, about relationships, about all of these things, which then inform our work and inform our ability, you know, to know what we are doing and to know what we want to do. And indeed, if we approach our work in the spirit of exploration or enjoyment or knowing what we want to do, we can derive a great deal of pleasure from it, and a sense of purposefulness and a sense of meaning.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the value of conversation for its own sake? Not necessarily to solve a problem, but just to engage with another person.
Mm. Well, you know, I mean, first of all, there is a very long tradition of, you know, considering dialogue a sort of basis of knowledge and of understanding. You know, we have Platonic dialogues. I mean, psychoanalysis is a kind of dialogue. So, you know, it is a way to understand ourselves, to understand others, to understand the world. But also, you know, it's a way of making full contact with another person. And I think, you know, this is a kind of basic human skill in which we're in danger of becoming de-skilled in it. Again, there is a very good book by Sherry Turkle called On Conversation, which sort of, you know, sounds an alarm bell about all of this, and how particularly young children who grow up in the digital environment are losing the basic skill, the knack, for making contact with other children and for sensing what other children feel. So, you know, so all of that is important. It's also, on another level, it's important for our public life, for our public discourse. You know, we need to, in our complicated societies and our often divided societies, we need to know how to really talk to another person, you know, with candor and understanding.
We're not getting a lot of great examples these days if we turn on the television and, you know, watch the news.
No, we're not getting great examples of that. And in a way, you know, the Twitter presidency may be the kind of terrible sort of culmination of all of these trends.
What do we miss out on by giving in to our fear of missing out?
We miss out on knowing who we are. And on acting in the world and on being with ourselves as ourselves. And, you know, while this may sound precious, I don't think it is. this is, you know, absolutely crucial to our well-being and to living meaningfully.
And how do we re-engage with our instinct to play? It used to be so easy to do this as kids, and it's hard to stop what we're doing and play now.
Well, you know, I mean, I think it's a wonderful idea to just, you know, take up an amateur activity, to take up some kind of, you know, play, which is also, you know, which also demands something of you. How do we learn how to play? Well, precisely, perhaps, you know, by cultivating experiences for their own sake. You know, again, the instinct to play, I think, is very natural. and, you know, if we can just give ourselves to our impulses and our instinct for enjoyment and our instinct for pleasure from time to time, we will be playing. And also, you know, again, I mean, it is, you know, we might remember that play is at the root of creativity and, you know, at the root of serious thought. I mean, you know, many scientists start by playing, you know, around with ideas or by engaging in amateur activities. I mean, Darwin was an amateur, you know, botanist, and he came to his discoveries through that, starting from that.
Eva Hoffman's new book is called How to Be Bored. Eva, it has been a great pleasure. Thanks very much for making time for us.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your very interesting questions.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can subscribe to our podcast and find out about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.